So let's consider two cases. Let me go back. So the first case is an emergency room physician who has a moral objection, conscience-based objection, to providing emergency contraception. And in addition to providing it, he also doesn't want to inform rape victims who come into the ED of the availability of something that can prevent pregnancy after intercourse. And studies show that some women are just unaware of this, so it's very important that they be informed of this. So he refuses. And the hospital in which he works it's common practice to offer emergency contraception to rape victims who come into the hospital. And so he asks for an accommodation. He wants to be allowed to refuse to inform or provide EC. And the second case is now a nurse, obstetrics gynecology nurse, and she has a moral objection to abortion. And this moral objection is not just to participate in the procedure, but she also objects to providing pre-abortion care and post-abortion care for patients. And she, too, asks for an accommodation. Now, an accommodation would mean that she wouldn't have to do the things to which she objects, and she would not be penalized for it. So the question then is, and this is the question I want to focus on for the remaining of the time, is, okay, well, what do we do in situations like those two cases? What is the appropriate response? Is it to accommodate, or is it to say, sorry, if you don't do it, you can't work here? And there are two kind of extreme answers to this question. One is, well, don't accommodate. And the reason that's given for this is, well, look, if the service is legal, if it's professionally accepted, if it's clinically appropriate, and it's within the scope of competence of the clinician, then they have a professional obligation to provide it. And if they can't provide it for reasons of conscience, then they shouldn't be doctors. The other extreme is just the opposite. Well, if somebody can't in good conscience provide a service, then you can't force them to do it. It's just completely wrong to require people to do anything against their conscience, so of course you have to accommodate them. Now, what I want to claim is that both of these... Oh, well, first, before I do that, since philosophers have a reputation of talking about stuff that doesn't exist, making things up, I just want to indicate that there are people who hold both of these extreme views. So, first of all, incompatibilism. A very well-known bioethicist, Julian Savulescu, a British bioethicist, basically says, look, if you can't provide a service that is legally permitted, efficient, and beneficial, then you shouldn't be a doctor. You should maybe be a philosopher or a lawyer, but not a doctor. And then an editorial in the New York Times about pharmacists, basically the same thing. Any pharmacist who can't dispense medicines lawfully prescribed by a doctor should find another line of work. So that's the one extreme, incompatibilism. And here's a rather long quote. I won't bother reading it, but basically the gist of it is, if a physician or any other healthcare provider has a moral objection to providing a service, then they should be accommodated, period. So those are the two extremes. And what I want to at least suggest is there are really problems with both of those extremes, and I want to recommend kind of a middle position that tries to avoid both extremes, and generally this kind of approach means that I'm I get objections from both ends. But at least I think, well, I'm going to suggest this is a reasonable way of approaching this situation. I'd be happy to hear what you think about this. So first of all, problems with conscience absolutism. That's the view that if anybody has an objection, then they have to be accommodated. So major problem with that is that health professionals, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, they are professionals, and as such, they have certain obligations as professionals. And these are kind of the core obligations that are really apply in most health professions. And that is an obligation to respect patient dignity and refrain from discrimination, an obligation to promote patient health and well-being. And in most codes, this obligation is very strong. It states that physicians, for example, have an obligation to put the interests of patients above their own interests. So it's a very strong obligation. And then finally, an obligation to respect patient autonomy. And those three core obligations pull in the opposite direction of accommodation. And the second consideration is that, well, if a physician or a nurse, like in case one or case two, if they are accommodated, then somebody else has to provide the service. In the case of the emergency room doctor, you can't just tell the patient, well, too bad. There has to be somebody else who takes over for that physician and does provide the information and maybe provide the EC if that's what the patient wants. And similarly in the case of the nurse, if she isn't going to participate in abortion, either pre or post, some other nurse has to. So that's going to put a burden on other health professionals and also on supervisors and maybe the administration. So that's another consideration against conscience absolutism. Now, the other extreme, incompatibilism, that says, well, you can't, if you are a doctor, then you just have to provide all these services and you can't object to providing them as long as they're legal, professionally accepted, etc., etc. The major problem with that is it treats doctors and nurses as just health professionals, and it disregards the fact that in addition to health professionals, they are moral agents. And as moral agents, they have an interest in maintaining their moral integrity. So what does it mean to compromise moral integrity? In other words, if a doctor or a nurse, in case one or case two, if the doctor said, if he's told, well, if you want to continue to work in this ED, you must provide that information, even though it compromises your moral integrity. And similarly with the nurse. So what's at stake when a person compromises their moral integrity? Well, I think, first of all, it assumes that a person, a nurse, a doctor, has certain very deep-seated core moral values. Then these are core moral values in the sense that it really is part of the person's understanding of who they are, of their self-perception or their identity. And then the service involved, whether it's emergency contraception, whether it's abortion, performing that service is contrary to their core moral values. And that would be what's involved in compromising one's moral integrity. So the idea is that accommodation, sort of the main goal of accommodation, would be to allow health professionals to continue to provide services, to continue to function in that setting without compromising their moral integrity. So question arises, okay, so why? What's the big deal about moral integrity? Why is it important to permit, to enable healthcare providers to maintain their moral integrity. And here's several answers to that. First, it can be very important to people. It can be part of their sort of notion of what a good life or a meaningful life is, to protect their moral integrity. Second, as we may have experienced ourselves, if you do something that really violates a core moral value, it can lead to considerable feelings of guilt, shame, and even, if it's deep enough, a loss of a sense of self-respect. This is somewhat speculative, but some bioethicists have said that if somebody does something that is contrary to their core moral values, it might lead to a decay in their moral commitments. It kind of eats at the fabric of their moral character. Respect for persons, which is a very important principle in bioethics, which sort of requires that we respect people's ability to live their lives according to their own conceptions of the good, according to their own values. That requires that we not undermine people's moral integrity. And I think, especially in its, time of politics, the idea that people actually have certain core moral principles, they're not just opportunists, I think is a valuable thing. Now, there are limits to that, right? We don't respect the moral integrity of diehard racists, for example. So there's some limits to that. But I think there's something to the idea that even if we disagree with somebody, within a certain range, if they have moral principles, we think that that's a good thing. So some additional reasons for accommodating. Respect for autonomy, again, another important ethical principle. Now, here's a notion that you might not be familiar with, epistemic modesty, which is not to be confused with relativism. Epistemic modesty is just the idea that, hey, sometimes we make mistakes. We make mistakes about factual beliefs, right? I mean, I don't think anybody has never been wrong about something. And we also make mistakes, or can make mistakes, about ethical beliefs. So there's a certain amount of then epistemic modesty where we say, well, maybe they're right. And that gives that sort of promote some notion that we ought to give people some moral space in which to follow their own lights in terms of moral things, moral matters. Moral progress. So sometimes the outlier today turns out in 20 years you say, wow, they really had it right. And in medicine, there's a case that comes to, well, for example, the doctors who objected to forced sterilizations in the early 1900s. At that time, they were viewed as being, well, they're wrong, they're moral outliers. But it turns out they were in hindsight, they were right. So that can be another reason. And then some practices continue to be controversial. Abortion, organ donation after cardiac determination or circulatory determination of death, and palliative sedation. Those are still controversial within the medical community, so that's another reason for accommodating people. Then, if you believe that tolerance is a good thing, that is to say, we should respect people with different values and different beliefs, then that's another reason to accommodate physicians who have beliefs that are outside the official mainstream. Diversity in the medical profession. So if one were just to adopt conscience absolutism, incompatibilism, then it might be that the medical profession would be would have no diversity at all. People with certain religious beliefs that are in the minority, like Muslims, they might not be in the medical profession. And finally, if people are told, doctors are told, well, leave your ethical beliefs at the door before you walk into the emergency department, that might discourage ethically sensitive people from entering the medical profession. And that, I think, we can all agree, would be a bad thing. We want doctors who are ethically sensitive. Okay, so what I've done is at least try to make the case for accommodation. I've also pointed out some difficulties in the two extremes. And so now what I want to present and have you sort of discuss with me is what I think to be a reasonable accommodation. And of course, nobody can object to a reasonable accommodation. But just because I call it a reasonable accommodation doesn't mean it really is. So this is just what I'm proposing as a way of trying to both respect the conscience of physicians and nurses who have moral objections, but at the same time acknowledge the fact that they have professional obligations toward patients and their colleagues. So this is the general aim of this reasonable accommodation, is to accommodate health professionals who have conscience-based objections without unduly compromising other values and interests. And so here is my sort of list of conditions that should be satisfied in order to accommodate. And we can go back and consider how this would apply to case one, the doctor in case one and the nurse in case two. So the first of these guidelines is basically, whenever possible and feasible and appropriate, healthcare providers should give advance notification. So think of the emergency room doctor. So the time to communicate his objection is not when the first rape victim comes into the emergency department. That's not going to be likely he's going to be accommodated, and it could be a real disruptive thing. So that should be communicated in advance, and then there might be a possibility of accommodating if the head of the emergency department knows about that in advance. Second condition has to do with the effect of accommodation on patients and surrogates. And what this basically says is the accommodation, again, think of the emergency room doctor, to accommodate that physician should not have the effect that patients who come into the emergency department, rape victims who come into the emergency department, don't get information about emergency contraception. Or in the case of the nurse, accommodating her should not mean that patients do not receive proper pre and post abortion care. I mean, that's excellent. That's the third one. I've jumped ahead one. Right. So the second one has to do with information and counseling, and the third one has to do with actually getting the procedure. And the accommodation shouldn't result in the patient either not getting the procedure or not getting it in a timely fashion. Then the fourth condition has to do with the effect on other physicians and nurses and maybe the supervisor and even the hospital itself. And finally, accommodation shouldn't enable invidious discrimination. Okay? So why don't we consider this now in relation to the two cases? Okay. Are there any questions about this before we do? Yeah.
Isn't there a conflict between number one and number five? I mean, how would you do number one without preventing a hospital from discriminating in hiring of a professional? Now, number five says okay. Invidious discrimination.
Yes.
Well, there's discrimination that's not invidious. I'm just not going to hire this doctor because or this nurse, because I'll have to employ two of them, one who will do and one who won't do. So how do you avoid that problem?
Okay, so you're saying that if the doctor in case one is, let's say, told we can't accommodate you,
or we won't even hire you.
Won't hire you. Okay, that's discrimination.
That is.
Okay. Well, granted, it is discrimination, and that's why I put the word invidious in there.
It's not invidious.
It's right. In other words, invidious discrimination. So discrimination is basically just making distinctions, right? And people make distinctions all the time. So discrimination is bad if it's unjustified or invidious. So if the refusal to hire somebody is justified, then it's not invidious. So the real question is, would it be justified to say to a physician, I'm sorry, we cannot hire you if you won't provide an essential service, at least what this hospital thinks is an essential service.
So it is discrimination.
It's discrimination, but it's justified discrimination.
Really?
Well, look, I mean, maybe I don't want to kind of be glib about this or play on words, but in a certain sense, any kind of criteria you have for deciding whether or not you're going to hire people is discrimination.
But
it's just not unjustified.
This is the best nurse in the country.
Okay.
Who is the most qualified, experienced, skilled.
Oops.
But the only reason you're hiring her is because of her moral beliefs. That's discrimination.
Well, the only reason you're not hiring is, right. Okay. Well, okay. The question is she the most qualified? So from the perspective of medical skills, let's say, she is the most qualified. Compared to me or another nurse, certainly compared to me, but compared to, so we have two nurses. One, went to, Harvard Nursing School, did fantastic in her boards, is just a dynamite nurse. And the other ones...
She got the Congressional
Medal of... Okay. Although that may not have anything to do with nursing, but anyway, okay. And the other one is, it's not that she's incompetent, right? She's a totally qualified nurse in terms of medical skills, personal skills, and all that. Now, here's what I would say. In terms of qualifications, it seems to me legitimate if, let's say, the hospital in the first case. If the hospital in the first case is committed to providing all women who come into the emergency department with information about emergency contraception, and if they request it, to provide those contraceptives, they think it's part of their mission, then a nurse who won't do that is not qualified. Right? That's a qualification of the job.
Would such a hospital have such a policy? Would any hospital have that kind of policy?
Well, I would argue they probably should.
Okay.
In the sense that this is a service that is, I think, very important to women, who victims of rape, and the medical profession, basically the perspective of the medical profession is that this is a service that is medically indicated in certain circumstances. It should be offered, et cetera, et cetera. I would think, that is a justified approach. Now, we could disagree about that, right? But I think here is where it's important to distinguish between one's personal views about, let's say, emergency contraception, on the one hand, and sort of what the medical community and what the society at large has to say about the importance of this particular service. Right? And that's where conscientious objection comes in. Well, obviously the physician doesn't agree with me, but the point is, I think, again, that there is a certain professional perspective on this, a professional take on this, and there are certain medical services, I think, that rightly are considered important and should be available to people. And again, the accommodation is that we will accommodate people who disagree. But there is an official view on this. The medical profession and society have official views on it. And insofar as they do, then if anybody objects to that, that's where we accommodate them if we can, as opposed to saying, well, we won't provide it, this service to people. Yeah, Tim?
So our tribute over NVIDIA's a little bit.
Okay.
My understanding of NVIDIA's is that it means an action that makes people angry or resentful.
Yeah.
And maybe I've got the wrong definition.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in listening to you, you're aiming towards unjustifiable.
Yes.
As the definition of NVIDIA's.
Yes.
Which is slightly different. I mean, there might be somebody who's committed the concept of all measures whatsoever, no matter what, to the end, to preserve life. And it would tick me off if you refused to hire me in a palliative care service,
mm-hmm.
Because I want to get into that service and prop people up with medical technology and right a terrible wrong that's going on in that clinic. But it would be completely justifiable because the mission of that clinic is to provide palliative care.
Correct. That's my view. Yeah. And
it would be invidious from my perspective because you
wouldn't like it.
I would resent it. I would be angry.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm pretty sure that's the way the term is used in the bioethics literature is justified, unjustified. But if I'm wrong about that, point well taken.
Well, I just wanted to make sure.
But yeah, but that's my meaning of it is that it's either unjustified or justified discrimination. And just to kind of put it in a more controversial context, I don't know which, but think of Planned Parenthood. The mission of Planned Parenthood is to help people in family planning. That's called Planned Parenthood. Now imagine somebody applies for a position at Planned Parenthood who has all of the great characteristics. They're a fantastic communicator. They're warm people. They're lovely people. You'd love to spend 10 hours with them. But they say, I just don't believe in family planning. Can you accommodate me? And I'd say, no, I'm sorry. Did you read the sign when you walked in? It said Planned Parenthood. And so we cannot accommodate. Even though you're a marvelous person, we're not saying anything about your personal attributes or your clinical skills. We're just saying that what we need here, and that's sort of what I'm saying about, which is more controversial, granted, but that's what I'm saying about services like emergency contraception. Yeah.
I want to push it a little bit in a little different direction. Imagine that you are a person, you are a physician who does not believe in immunization.
Right.
And there are people who believe that, the bad effects from that. So if you were a physician who refused that,
mm-hmm.
then to me, that would be even less acceptable than these other things. And I'm just wondering if you pick something a little more extreme, if that helps us to understand why it doesn't make sense for people to apply for a position which they refuse to carry out.
Right. So, and that's a great example. At least suggesting is that, vaccination is something that is clearly a very core procedure, very core service within the medical profession, within the pediatric profession. And so any pediatrician who doesn't provide that would be sort of, I'm sorry, this is an essential medical service. It's scientifically documented, yada, yada, yada. And that's sort of what I'm using as a frame to apply to the two cases here, where even so, even though it's not that the disagreement about, say, the disagreement about vaccinations is, are they beneficial or are they harmful? And some people object because they think it's harmful, not beneficial. They think that cause autism, right? And those beliefs have really been completely refuted, scientifically refuted. Now, there's some people who don't want their kids to be vaccinated because they believe that in sort of, they don't believe in medicine, or they don't believe in that kind of medicine. It's, they want all some sort of alternative practice, whatever. But it seems to me a physician, and I totally agree with you, that's a clear case where you say, if you're a pediatrician, that's a service you have to offer or provide. Now, I'm sort of thinking that the same thing, and we can disagree about that, but I'm thinking that emergency contraception is like that. It's just more controversial. But it's still, like vaccination, it's something that's accepted within the medical profession, and it's considered to be not only a legitimate service, but also an important one for patients to have. And again, my kind of take on all of this is, let's try to accomplish two objectives. One, patients get the service, as long as it's legal, professionally accepted, clinically appropriate. Let's make sure they are informed about it and they get it. And then let's do the best we can to accommodate people who don't want to provide it. And this is no surprise, but this is going to make accommodation extremely context dependent. So you take the case of the nurse. Well, it's going to depend on the size of the hospital, the staff, OBGYN nurses. Is this a large, like, is it UPMC? Is it McGee Women's? Well, if it's a McGee Women's, they probably have enough of nurses on the staff that they can accommodate that one nurse without putting any undue burden on anybody else. But now think it's a small community hospital, maybe in a rural area, where there's just a few nurses. So to accommodate that nurse would require other nurses to work double time. Well, no. Or to hire another nurse. Well, this hospital is, you know, like making, just getting by, just, but they can't hire, they can't afford to hire another nurse. So it's going to be very context dependent on whether or not individuals can or cannot be accommodated. Yeah?
Back in the 60s and 70s, I was a burn and trauma nurse in Cincinnati. And one evening we had a patient admitted, the cutest little old lady, heavy set, a black woman. She was just everybody's grandmother. Everybody would just fall in love with her because she was so cute. And the nurse refused to take care of her, and she was fired instantly.
Because she was black.
The reason she refused was, the woman, it turned out, within a couple of minutes, it seemed like two men were stationed outside her room, and we wondered what was going on and everything, and we found out that she was a hitman for the mafia, and that she had killed five people that they knew of. So the nurse refused to take care of her. Now,
did the nurse refuse because she was black or because
no, she refused because she didn't like the fact that the woman was a murderer.
Oh, okay. She knew that.
Yeah, we did know that.
You did know it.
We did know that. Okay. But she refused. She was fired on the spot because the doctor said that your job is not to morally or ethically rate the patient and whether you want to treat them or not. Your job is to keep them comfortable and give them palliative care.
Right.
And so she was fired.
Right. Well, I mean, there is a sort of a principle within medicine that people should get medical care despite, no matter what kind of people they are. And keep in mind that even in war, enemy soldiers are given medical treatment if they're captured. And the other thing is, keep in mind that prisoners on death row are given medical treatment. In fact, they're not executed unless they get, if they're sick, you can't execute them, you have to give them medical treatment. So the thing is, I think, that bad people, still should get medical care, because it's not up to medical professions to decide who lives and who dies, right? That's up to the legal profession.
The nurse, if the nurse had taken part in the abortion, mm-hmm. and assisted the doctor, I can understand her refusing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But to give the patient care afterwards.
Yep. Well, and that's why I put it up there, because it is very controversial, and it really gets to this notion of moral complicity. And I think that's a very, very controversial issue as to what you have to do, how involved one has to be morally complicit. And my view on it is, it is so philosophically complex and complicated that I'd rather leave it up to the person, herself or himself, to tell me what they feel about it. And if it's possible to accommodate that nurse, rather than telling her, well, come on, caring for a patient after an abortion, that's not complicity. If she really genuinely feels that somehow that would disrupt her core moral values to do that, then rather than saying, well, you've got a faulty conception of complicity, I'd rather say, okay, well, let's see if we can accommodate you without jeopardizing patient care and without putting undue burdens on other nurses. And if we can, then I think there's no reason not to. Now, some people will disagree and they will say, no, we ought to first have some notion of how we draw the borders in of complicity, and say, oh, this is ridiculous. That's not complicity. Or it could say, but anyway, that's my view. Is I'd rather bend over backwards, again, provided it doesn't have any ill effect on patients or doesn't place an undue burden on other nurses. That's right. But again, there's a lots of room for disagreement on this. Yeah. Yep.
For not employing a person who expresses conscientious objection.
Okay, I'm not a lawyer. This is a complicated question. I'll try to make it as simple as I can. So there's kind of two things at play here. One is the requirement that employers give people, in fact, the language is the same, reasonable accommodation. Right. So it would be dependent then on whether or not refusing to hire this person violates that legal requirement of reasonable accommodation. And I would argue it would have something, it would be very similar to what I said about, the clear case of Planned Parenthood. Right? It seems to me you couldn't argue that there was a reasonable accommodation you could give to somebody who says, I don't believe in family planning. Now, that's a clear case. Borderline cases, that's where it gets awfully messy.
Do you know, does it give a right to a person who has been denied employment or promotion, whatever, the right to sue a private?
Sure. Yes, there's, I mean, look, this is the United States. Anybody can sue anybody, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Handicapped individuals.
Right, and that there's the Americans with Disabilities. Right. Right. But again, it's reasonable accommodation. That's the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that's the same sort of language. Employers are required to make a reasonable accommodation, but that means that if they can make a case that this particular person with this disability just cannot perform, they've done within reason, they just can't perform that service, then they haven't violated that law. Now, the other thing that complicates the picture is, I'm not sure people are aware, but HHS, Health and Human Services Department, recently issued regulations that protect the conscience rights of healthcare providers. And very, very strong protection. So in answer to your question, I would probably say, well, according to that regulation, employers might be in hot water, because that regulation is kind of toward the end of the spectrum that I've called conscience absolutism. Now, that law has been, that regulation has been ruled has been rejected by a federal court. Of course, the administration is appealing it, but right now it's not in effect. But if it ever does go into effect, I think the answer to your question will be employers have to be very, very, very careful. Much more careful than they are today, where we're talking about the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Title VII, that just requires reasonable accommodation.
I think that I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, please.
I think that the legislation you were alluding to was in relationship to conscientious objection to treating LGBTQ folks.
No, the LGBTQ was not legislation, that was a regulation. And what the Trump administration, I can't believe I blanked on Trump, the Trump administration did was basically to reverse the Obama administration regs on that. The Obama administration said that we will understand sexual discrimination to include discrimination against LGBTQ people. And Trump's administration said, no, we'll make it very narrow, so it's just based on gender and nothing else. What I'm referring to is a sweeping general regulation that protects the conscience rights of healthcare professionals. One of the things, we're talking about invidious or unjustified discrimination, one of the things about that regulation, which again is not into effect because of court ruling, is that it probably would permit hospitals and employers to discriminate against people on the basis of their sex and gender, et cetera, et cetera. There are no protections in that legislation, in that regulation. There are no protections. Yeah.
I'm wondering how, as a philosopher, you deal with what I, as a non-philosopher, think of as the infinite capacity of humans to rationalize things. So I can concoct a conscientious objection to right. something that is
right.
in my own construct.
Right. Well, that's a good question. And here there's considerable disagreement among people who have written on the subject of conscientious objection in healthcare. Needless to say, I sort of take a moderate position on this. Some people require what they call a public justification of their objection. A public justification that satisfies either the department head or a licensing board or an ethics committee or somebody that you are able to justify, sufficiently justify your objection. And that would rule out all these, you know, Now, my view is that I worry that if people have to justify their objection to someone else, and there aren't very, very clear guidelines on what is a good justification and what is not a good justification, that this could be subject to a lot of subjectivity and arbitrariness. And maybe a lot of some bias too, right? Especially if people's objections are religiously based. And the other part, the other thing, the other consideration I have is some people may be better than others in giving justifications, right? I mean, for almost 40 years, I taught undergraduates. And I learned that some people are better at giving justifications, they're better at moral reasoning than other people. And it doesn't mean they didn't have really deep-seated, firm moral beliefs, it's just they couldn't articulate them. And my view, again, I kind of really think it's important to give people moral space to maintain their moral integrity. So I kind of would rather err on the side of giving people the benefit of the doubt, which doesn't mean you can't engage in a conversation with them to make sure that these really are deep-seated moral beliefs, right? Because people can have objections that are that won't have the kind of catastrophic effect on them as, let's say, the nurse in case two, right? That probably would have a catastrophic effect on her if she were required to participate in an abortion. Whereas some people, like, they don't, they object to providing intensive care to an 85-year-old patient who is has a multiple medical conditions, and they say, you know, this is a waste of resources. I object to this. Well, people kind of accept injustices all the time. It doesn't have a catastrophic or devastating effect on them. They just think it's wrong. But it, and so what I think you can do, at least legitimately, say, is engage in a, if you're a department head, make sure that the objection of the nurse and the doctor really is a deep-seated moral objection. But don't kind of require them to provide a justification of it that would be satisfactory, because again, what criteria are we using to determine whether a justification is satisfactory? Donnie, but there are people who take the, you know, take a much harder line on this and say, people, we, and the other thing I think of is, look, one of the worries is, why would we be worried about people concocting these phony objections? Well, one reason is we'd be worried about the effect it has on patients. Well, I've taken care of that by my conditions on accommodation, right? It doesn't have anything to do with reasons. It has to do with figuring what the effect will be on patients. And I think the other worry is, oh, this will be opening the floodgates to people objecting. And I don't know. I just don't think that's a realistic worry. I mean, I don't see loads and loads of doctors and nurses now using this as an excuse not to provide procedures. But again, people do disagree, and people take a more hardline view that we should require some justification so we don't have these, you know, phony kind of objections. Yeah?
This is really an excellent seminar. Philosophers get a bad rap. Do you have anything to say about that? Because you're presenting this as a philosopher. Really great.
Well, okay, so let me ask you, what's the bad rap based on?
The bad rap is that philosophy has nothing to do with real life.
With real life, yeah. Okay. Well, if it really depends on which philosopher you're talking about, right? So, for example, University of Pittsburgh Philosophy Department, which is one of the top-rated philosophy departments in the world, they would say what I'm doing, which is applied ethics, isn't philosophy, right? So that just gives you an idea, so that's just to sort of confirm what you're saying, that what I'm doing and sort of what I take my role to be as an educator is to try to make things accessible and not get too much into the clouds. But again, people in the Pitt philosophy department would say, well, Wicklare's not a real philosopher.
You're doing applied philosophy.
Yes.
Yes.
And they don't, that's not philosophy. Or even worse, applied ethics, right? Applied ethics. They believe in ethics, but it's meta-ethics, not applied ethics, right? So, anyway, thanks for the compliment. Any other, or is it time? Or is time?
No, we've run out of time.
Okay. Well, anyway, thanks a lot for your participation.